Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
We've got an oven-ready deal. Put it in the microwave. We can get a new deal. We're aiming for a new deal. I've looked carefully at no deal. That outcome would be a failure of statecraft. The people of this country deserve better from their leaders.
Buenos dias, good afternoon. It's 3 minutes past 12. It's Monday, the 28th of December. And whichever one he was talking about there, we do have a deal. Slim as it may be, it's nonetheless 1,246 pages, plus plenty of footnotes.
Tonight, on Christmas Eve, I have a small present for anyone who may be looking for something to read in that sleepy post-Christmas lunch moment. And here it is. Tidings, glad tidings of great joy, because this is a deal. A deal to give certainty to business and travellers and all investors in our country from the 1st of January. A deal with our friends and partners in the EU. You remember the oven-ready deal by which we came out on January the 31st? That oven-ready deal was just the starter. This is the feast, full of fish, by the way. And I believe it will be the basis of a happy and successful and stable partnership with our friends in the EU for years to come. So that's it. That's the good news from Brussels. Now for the sprouts, and a happy Christmas to you all.
The clock is no longer ticking. After 4 years of collective effort and EU unity to preserve peace and stability on the island of Ireland, to protect the citizens and the single market, to build a new partnership with the UK. Thank you all. Thank you all. This is the work of so many women and men here in the Commission, under your leadership, Madam the President, all the services, and in particular the EU Task Force for the Brexit, with Clara Martinez and Paulina Dejmek, and all the team. And in the Member States, the Council, the European Parliament. I also pay tribute also to the EU-UK negotiating team, and the chief negotiator David Frost and his deputies. This process has engaged so many citizens, businesses, stakeholders, and obviously so many journalists. Thank you for your patience and for your attention. Today is a day of relief, but tinged by some sadness, as we compare what came before with what lies ahead.
So, the white smoke, I suppose, not quite papal level, but maybe an ashtray's worth, is this deal. So it's, look, in economic terms, I know people wanted it for other sort of romantic reasons, perhaps. The issue of free movement of people, fish, really didn't go. It did come up actually during the referendum. Do you remember Bob Geldof and Nigel Farage having it out on the Thames? So I suppose it did come up. But clearly, financially speaking, it's going to be worse than being a member. I understand that that's not the only consideration, clearly not the main consideration for many people. So the agreement will make trade between the UK and the EU more complicated than it has been while Britain was a member of the bloc. We have zero tariffs, zero quotas, with strings attached, but that doesn't mean to say that it's zero paperwork. All sorts of aspects, especially, it's not exclusively, but especially in things like agriculture, sanitary and phytosanitary paperwork to go through. But it goes quite a way to smoothing the cliff edge that would have been inevitable if no trade deal had been struck at all. We would have been like, and it's hard to pick a country because I could say Mongolia, but then you scratch beneath the surface and it turns out that the EU has all sorts of mini semi-trade deals with places around the world, apart from, you know, more fleshed out ones such as CETA with Canada, one with Japan, one with Vietnam, and so on. Still negotiating with Australia, for example. The agreement on paper will also likely evolve during its implementation. Yeah, so it ain't over, really. We've got this deal, so that carries us over from the 1st of January. But then there are all sorts of things that they want to continue to negotiate on to see if we can't tighten things up, if you like, make them smoother, I suppose. But that makes the consequences harder to judge for some areas than for others. As I say, it's 1,246 pages. As far as trade deals is concerned, that's not necessarily large, but it is large in the time period that we have. I mean, the agreement was announced on Christmas Eve, just in time for the Christmas present, of course. Between yesterday, Michel Barnier met EU ambassadors, so the ambassadors, permanent ambassadors to the European Union from each of the 27 countries to explain to them. EU ministers, between now and the 31st, EU ministers are expected to sign the deal so that it's applied provisionally. Obviously, for it to be fully ratified and everything, it has to go to the European Parliament to be approved. And then, depending on the competences, it may need to be ratified by individual parliaments as well. That's where there could be a sticking point. That means they would need to ratify any area that encroaches on the national sovereignty of any of the 27 countries rather than things that are just EU competences. On the 30th of December, so 28, 29, 30, so this Wednesday, the day after tomorrow, the British Parliament will be recalled to vote on the deal. Now, at least it's already in English. Remember, it has to be translated, probably has been by now, I would think, but it has to be translated into 23 or so languages. Fair enough. People can't sign it if they don't understand it. But British parliamentarians, well, they've only had a few days, really, to read over the thing and to maybe cite objections. It's expected that the debate will be something like 3 hours, which, all right, you know, better than no deal, but 3 hours after all of these years and then 3 hours to debate it, something which will affect the UK for generations, generation at least. Then, of course, the 31st of December, the Brexit transition period ends. And then at some point in the new year, January, maybe February, we'll see, the EU Parliament has to vote unanimously to approve the deal before the Council adopts the decision. Things that aren't in there, for example, financial services, the first area detailed in the declarations, isn't covered comprehensively in the full trade agreement. Instead, the declarations include an agreement to try and reach a memorandum of understanding by March of next year. That might mean that the two sides agree to recognise each other's rules, a process known as equivalence. This is financial services we're talking about. This is a huge one for the UK, of course. It's a net exporter of financial services to the EU, as opposed to goods, which are covered. It's a net importer. So you can be forgiven for scratching your head and wondering how that's a particularly good deal for the UK. Okay. And if they do manage to get something by March of next year, that would allow the finance industry to trade across the border between the UK and the EU. It's long been a contentious issue. Financial services, that rare area where the UK has a clear competitive advantage over the EU. But the EU is seeking to onshore far more of its financial services activity, particularly in terms of bond trading and contracts tied to the euro. The European Banking Authority, after Brexit happened, medicine went to Amsterdam, banking went to Paris. There are many companies that have moved large swathes of their operations to the likes of Frankfurt, for example. Frankfurt is physically a lot smaller than London. It's also a lot smaller, you know, in terms of financial services. But the EU wants to encourage more companies to go that way. Clearly, they want the business and the jobs and all of the things that, that go with that. I know from a few people, a few friends, that it's had an effect on rental prices, of course, in Frankfurt. People coming in, it's quite difficult for people, especially if they're not on, you know, some pretty significant wages, quite hard for them to find you know, affordable housing there. As far as equivalence decisions granted by the EU is concerned, so even if we do get that deal on some sort of equivalence on financial services by March of this coming year, 2021, it's not the same as being in the EU. equivalence notices can be withdrawn at very short notice. I think it's 30 days, as Switzerland has discovered. So that's off-putting for investors who want legal certainty about the status of cross-border contracts. It's somewhat impractical, or at least challenging, for financial stability, given the volume of outstanding contracts between the two parties. As I say, London, as you know, is one of the biggies in the world for this. So the scale is just astronomical compared to, you know, what we've seen in the likes of Switzerland. If a UK-based company wants to serve customers in an EU member country by setting up an office there, for example, then the market access and regulation will vary from country to country. So again, you know, you might have one rule in Romania, another one in Germany, another one in Spain, and then the companies will have to adapt accordingly. As far as country-specific rules are concerned, as with lots of trade deals, there are frequent references to things called reservations. That's the thing, as I say, the mixed competencies. Some power lies with the member state, some with the European Commission. And so market access and regulation will need to be determined member state by member state. For example, anyone who doesn't speak Spanish or German, whatever, would need a legal translation on implications for financial services from national reservations there. Professional services, lawyers seem to have been mentioned. I mean, I'll probably at some point actually read the full thing, but I haven't had a chance yet. Forgive me, a little bit of Christmas going on. And Boxing Day, St. Stephen's Day. As far as professional services is concerned, there is something in there to recognize legal qualifications, but not others. It's a thing called the Mutual Recognition of Professional Qualifications, MRPQs. And you've got things like doctors, engineers, architects, of course, allowing them to work in member states other than where they were qualified. That could be an issue. One member of the UK negotiating team says what the deal does is establish a process in which regulators and industry bodies can work with each other to establish MRPQs in the future. The thing about this is that you might have, just as an example, and it doesn't seem to be a big problem with architects, as I understand it, but you might have, for example, if a British architect wanted to do some work in Spain, then they would need the Spanish Architects Association, yeah, the official official body, the College of Architects, if you like, to agree. And of course, in many sectors, they might say, well, you know what, we don't want the competition. If you want to build something in Spain, use a Spanish architect. You know? That's just an example where this could be an issue. The two sides also won't recognize each other's system of rules designed to protect humans, animals and plants from diseases and pests. That means that British farmers wanting to export to the EU would need things like vet certifications, which weren't needed when the UK was an EU member. Same goes for EU farmers exporting into Britain. This won't cover Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland will continue to follow EU rules. And in fact, even nothing to do with Brexit, really, but there are sanitary and phytosanitary controls, say, for example, on livestock going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. And this, not as far as I know, it's nothing to do with Brexit. It's just to protect the island of Ireland, you see, you know, from, I don't know, the wrong type of cow going there, you see, one with maybe disease, and then the disease is on the island itself. Yeah. On standards, this is another one. There's some substantial points in the deal covering mutual recognition of standards, rules that allow one regulator's rubber stamp to carry clout in the other jurisdiction. So we trust your regulator. If you say it's good enough, then it's good enough for us. But there'll be considerable non-tariff barriers there. So, if, for example, medicine, there's an annex that sets out an agreement on mutual recognition of inspections and good manufacturing practice. So, essentially, if the European Medicines Agency says that a drug is good to go, then the UK will recognize that fact, will trust that, you know, they're not trying to kill the Brits. And the thing is, though, it doesn't mean that the paperwork won't be dramatically increased. But at least they will be recognized. It avoids doubling up on processes, of course, for the two markets. And the pharma industry had pushed for that because it's expensive for them to have. They have to pay for the EMA, or the British equivalent, to, you know, check the drug. There's one win for the car industry. as we have no tariffs, no quotas, but it doesn't mean that there's not going to be a lot of paperwork for the car industry. And a lot of that revolves around the rules of origin requirements, and they're phasing it in over a 6-year period. What it means is that if you've got, say, for example, a car made in Britain and you want to sell it in France, then cars, of course, are made up of, you know, hundreds or thousands of pieces, and they don't all come from the country concerned. All these bits come up, say, from China is, of course, a big exporter of car parts. So they come into the UK, for example, and then they put the car together. But there's a rule on how much of the stuff that goes up to make something that's exported can be from outside that country. Under the deal, a maximum of 60% of the content in finished electric vehicles, plug-in hybrid models and conventional hybrid models can come from outside the EU or the UK. So maximum of 60%. So that's quite high. So if the car's made in Valencia and it's sold in the UK, only 40% of it actually has to come from the EU for it to be considered from the EU and therefore tariff free. But the idea is to phase that amount down by 2023. It should be reduced. Let me see, 60% by the end of 2023. And then by the end of 2026, it should be a maximum of 55%. From 2027, it should be reduced to 45%. So a majority of the car is made either in the EU or the UK, depending which way it's going. So the car industry seems to be, you know, they'd rather that none of this happened. But dentro de lo que cabe, you know, within the realms of this, that it's not too bad for them. And this might help to allay fears of the likes of Nissan in Sunderland closing down, you know. Visas and labour, just two more things here for you now. Visas and labour mobility. Ending freedom of movement, of course, was a key issue for many people who voted Brexit. That's been achieved by the deal. But there's an issue not just of the recognition of qualifications, but for some professions, the ability to work in another country temporarily is key. Something recognised in the deal with a list that allows specified occupations, such as lawyers, visa-free travel for 90 days. This isn't the normal 90 days as a tourist, you know, 90 in every 180 in the Schengen area. This is a separate visa for professionals, you know, doing some work temporarily inside the EU or vice versa. If you get in the future, one of you listening, if you say living in the UK and you're going to work next year for 3 months somewhere in Europe, the 90 days as a lawyer, for example, that won't count against your tourism time. Yeah. So that's on top. But there are many industries that just haven't been included in this. And some of them, you know, they do travel around quite a bit, including sports professionals, artists and musicians are not on the list. So that's likely to be tested by lawyers before too long. So, you know, in theory, it means you're a musician. You can't, you know, go busking or doing concerts around Europe. And also is an added thing that's going to be believed to be quite pricey and a lot of paperwork involved is these things known as carnets in Spanish, or carnet, or carnet in French. But it's basically like a passport for goods. And it's the sort of stuff used by musicians and sports people moving their gear around. Imagine a decent-sized concert. There's all the musical instruments and all the PA system and all of that. Well, you'll need to pay and go through loads of paperwork. You know, we know sometimes you buy a laptop in Hong Kong back in the day. Don't know if it's still cheaper, probably. But, you know, and sometimes you get customs officers wanting you to prove that you'd taken it with you to Hong Kong on holiday and you were bringing it back rather than that you'd bought it there. You see what I mean? And then you were trying to skirt the import excise duty. And the final thing, we'll have a lot more detail over this over the coming decades. Put you off. But the issue of if there's a disagreement on implementation, some sections of the deal have their own dispute resolution mechanisms, but some don't. So that still has to be ironed out. If the two sides disagree, you're cheating. No, we're not. You are. How do you go about solving this? There's something they're calling it you know, you hear this word arbitration panel, I wrote it down, a partnership council. There's a new term for us to learn in Brexit world, a partnership council. Basically, a rough guide would be to assume a row, disagreement in many instances, would trigger a consultation process. If that fails, an arbitration panel, and that should also fail, then the imposition of some tariffs. That's not unusual in trade agreements. You know, if you've got a trade agreement, I don't know, NAFTA or whatever it's called now, the new version, you know, but Canada, US, Mexico, in a sort of semi-parallel with the EU, the United States has managed to elbow its way into many areas in that deal because it's much more powerful than Mexico and Canada. But if there's a change, you know, in the circumstances, Canada and the US agree on something, and then if one of them sort of changes its subsidy levels or whatever, makes it more competitive, the farmers or manufacturers on the other side would complain to their government, so you can have tariffs kick in to try and counterbalance that. And ultimately, of course, you take this to the World Trade Organization. One of the issues with them at the moment is that they're in a bit of a mess as far as the approval of the board is concerned, and there are cases at the WTO that have been dragging on for years, so there's that issue. But, you know, we could get something sort of more dramatic like action, like, for example, if there's a dispute on fish, yeah, then each party could lock the other out of their waters. You know, and if there's a serious dispute, it could be, we hear about these two Royal Navy vessels, two in the whole of the UK. And then we hear noises, say, from some French fishermen that, you know, if they felt really unhappy, they'd blockade French ports. And, of course, that's where fish arise, because we don't eat our fish. We buy fish, you know, the British buy cod from Europe, and we sell herring and mackerel to Europe, you know, which we fish. So, anyway, so there you go. It's a little bit of an intro for you. In a few minutes' time, I'll be speaking again to Jill Rutter from the UK in A Changing Europe. If there's one person that might have read it, it's her. Okay. I think there's a better chance that Jill Rutter has read it than Boris Johnson at the moment. But anyway, so we'll be speaking to Jill in just a few minutes' time.
Talk Radio Europe.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
Bienvenidos, son las 12:30. It's 12:30, an hour early in the Canaries, the UK, Ireland, Portugal, of course. And I'm delighted once again to be joined by Jill Rutter from the UK in A Changing Europe. Jill, good afternoon or good morning to you. No oigo nada. I think we have this problem with line 2 instead of line 1. So, Jill, hello?
Yeah, hello.
Oh, hi. Okay, I don't know what happened there. Jill, welcome back, and thanks for joining us, particularly, of course, over the holiday season. So, we have a deal. Have you read it?
I've read some of it, let's be honest. Other colleagues have read more of it, but I have read some of it, yes. So, annexes.
I was going to say, at least it's a bit shorter than we were saying the other day, about 2,000 pages. I have 1,246, but presumably all the annexes.
No, that includes the annexes. So the actual deal itself is only about 400 pages, so the rest are annexes. So.
So do you think, where do we go from here? Obviously, it's better than no deal for the consequences for, you know, for quotas and tariffs. But what do you think of the deal?
So what do I think of the deal? Well, it's a deal. That's the first thing you can say. And you're right that the main thing it does is avoid quotas and tariffs. That was an objective of both sides. Doesn't do terribly much for UK services businesses. It does a bit in the way of sort of easement of some of those border formalities, not least through a provision for mutual recognition of trusted trader schemes. But those, you know, border checks will still come in, and the EU hasn't announced any phasing on the 1st of January. So the UK is going to phase in its border controls over a 6-month period, but the EU hasn't at the moment said it's going to do anything similar on its side. So there is still a risk of some degree of disruption. But obviously in the UK, we've been watching a lot of disruption at the Short Straits border in the last week, not because of Brexit, but because of the closure of the French border because of COVID and the new variant. So that's there. I think the agreement does more on, we don't talk about it very much, but it does more on security cooperation than people expected it might do. It doesn't go as far as maintaining current levels of security cooperation, but there'll be arrangements for exchanging DNA information, passenger name records, and, you know, cooperation with Europol, Eurojust, all those sorts of things, extradition.
Just on that, I saw that DNA and fingerprint exchange was in, but we're out of Europol, we will be out of Europol, and we won't have access to the Schengen database, which the police say is very important in the UK. They access it millions of times a day.
They do, but we were never going to get access to the Schengen information system, because if you don't want to be bound by the European Court of Justice, I don't think the EU is ever going to agree to that. So that was sort of, you know, unrealistic. What they have done is agree something on extradition, which you know, is in the shape of the agreement they gave Norway and Iceland. But those took a really long time to negotiate with Norway and Iceland. So that will mean that it's much easier to extradite people to the UK and vice versa. Extraditions to the UK, though, come with the caveat that it's, as some countries ban the extradition of their citizens to non-EU countries. They change their constitutions to allow extradition to EU countries, but they're going to change them again for the UK. But then those cases, there are sort of commitments that they'll try the people locally or give a reason why they don't. So I don't know whether that's worrying news for criminals or not, but anyway, that's something I don't think people necessarily thought would have as EU cooperation. But that's all quite useful, having that degree of security cooperation. What else is in it? I mean, Joe, UK is going to participate in some EU programs, potentially the big science research programme. A lot of UK universities were very keen on doing that, but not in the Erasmus Student Exchange Scheme. The UK said it couldn't find a way of doing that that would represent value for money. And I think that's because a lot more EU students come and study in the UK than UK students go and study in the EU. So that's why it seemed to be a bit unbalanced.
Yeah, they've said they're going to set up something. I heard 100 and something million pounds, the budget.
We haven't seen the details yet. Yeah, so there's going to be a global student exchange program called the Turing Program, after the mathematician Alan Turing, yeah. Which they have announced a bit. But at the moment, it looks that it's just about supporting UK students to go abroad. Obviously, one of the things that a lot of EU students liked was the opportunity to come and study in UK universities and improve their already very good English further. It looks as though that probably, it's not clear that there's an inbound provision as well as an outbound one. So we'll have to see how that pans out in practice.
So just briefly on that, so if, for example, the UK's £150 million budget, then they would use that money to pay for British students if they wanted to study abroad, whether in the EU or somewhere else in the world, like the United States, of course. Why couldn't Europe do the same with the Erasmus budget? Then they could use it to pay for someone to study in the UK.
Yeah, they probably could. I don't know. We'll wait to see the details or whether the EU says, well, you know, we've got a perfectly good student exchange scheme that third countries can access. The UK had that opportunity. We're disappointed it didn't take it, and therefore we won't be extending it to the UK. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to wait to see how that. I'm not sure you can get out of Erasmus and then get in through the back door. But we will see whether something along those lines develops, and indeed how much this Turing scheme facilitates people going to universities in the EU as opposed to just more globally. So we'll see how that pans out. At the moment, we're very short of details.
Yeah, I see £100 million apparently is the budget now. When Switzerland had, not the last one, but the previous referendum to try and limit freedom of movement from EU citizens into Switzerland, one of the retaliations from the EU was to cut Switzerland out of Erasmus. And this, I seem to remember the Swiss government at the time, they just decided to plug that gap themselves, just put the money up themselves. So a Swiss student wouldn't really notice any difference. Yeah. The EHIC, you know, obviously it's something very important for our listeners. And I see that in the deal, all EHIC cards issued before the end of the year will be valid until their expiry date. And then Britain's bringing in something that we don't know the details, or I don't, called a global health insurance card. Any details on that? That's something of big concern to our listeners, of course.
No, I mean, this is a really interesting point, Stephen, because this was one of the things we didn't really expect to see, the continuation of EHIC. So in that sense, it's really good news, because very good news for Brits, particularly those who might have difficulty getting travel insurance at all or at a reasonable price. They still want to travel to the EU. So that seemed to be very, very good news that EHIC would continue. And I think over time, the UK might want to include other countries in its scheme, which is why it might be choosing this global health insurance branding. I think one of the things we'll see probably is the government trying to, you know, reorientate, rebrand, if you like, away from European to other things. At the moment, it's not clear that it has other deals to put in there. So that may be a bit of the thinking behind rebranding the name. But really, really interestingly and slightly worryingly, on this, Michael Gove on the radio this morning, and I have to admit to your listeners, I've been doing other things this morning, so I haven't followed this one up. But one of the things that Michael Gove was warning people living in the UK, of course, if you already got your sort of Spanish residency, your EU residency, you're okay on this anyway. But people in the UK, that if they were planning on travelling to the EU, of course, very, very difficult at the moment with all the pandemic restrictions in place, that you needed to make sure you had comprehensive health insurance. Now, you would have thought that the existence of EHIC made that not so necessary. So it's not completely clear to me whether he thinks there might be some sort of gap, whether that's if you don't have a valid EHIC card, or whether he'd just forgotten they'd done that provision. So we'll have to check up on that. That seemed to be a bit of variance with this assurances on EHIC.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that way around, what Michael Gove said, I didn't hear him this morning, so that's brought a bit more sunshine into my breakfast. Of course, we're talking about not EU residents in the UK, because they would be on the NHS if they're paying social security contributions.
Not EU residents, nor British residents in the EU.
Travellers, visitors.
This will be for travellers, so that's different different to people who've already secured their health benefits as part of their residence, as part of their rights, having exercised their free movement rights, as long as they've regularised their status in the country that they're living in now.
Yeah, I see just on that, because our listeners might not know, but the UK has, and this is Brexit or no Brexit, the UK has reciprocal health deals with a few non-EU countries like Australia and New Zealand, so tourists can receive urgent treatment basically under the same conditions as an Australian or a New Zealander.
Somebody who broke their elbow during an Ashes test in Australia, can I say that actually it's incredibly easy to access healthcare in Australia as a Brit? Though one British nurse at the hospital in Sydney did ask to see my passport before he agreed to take the staples out of my plaster, which I thought was a bit unnecessary. But in Perth, when I turned up at A&E, there were absolutely no questions about treating me for nothing. So that worked extraordinarily well.
Yeah, I mean, like the EHIC in Europe, because it's not necessarily free. Each country varies, of course. The UK, free at the point of use, as we know. But basically, you've got to be treated like a national of that country. Yeah. The same sort of terms and conditions.
So we need government to be clear. And I think this is a more general point, Stephen, is that having just done the deal on Thursday lunchtime, Thursday 3 o'clock UK time, 4 o'clock GET, but the government hasn't yet, as far as you can see, downloaded loads of new guidance about what this deal really means now they've done it. Particularly acute, I think, in the case of businesses who will need to sort of, you know exactly what they need to do to benefit from this. Of course, one of the things that the government is making very clear is a lot of those no-deal preparations were also needed for for a deal. And,
for a deal, I mean, yeah.
But,
Tony and Ben Almadena, a listener on the Costa del Sol, says, he says, they always say take up private insurance. Yeah, I've seen that because they're saying take up private insurance, self-insurance, but I seem to remember at fco.gov.uk or FCDO as it is now, of course, that they always say that, don't they? Even, it's just standard, you know, top yourself up, I suppose.
And that's in case you want coverage for those local charges or you want something that's not covered and things like that. So,
yeah. Here's a question from another listener. This is from John in Murcia, in the southeast of Spain. I'll forgive you if you don't know this one because I'm scratching my head myself, Jill. He says, my name's John, a UK resident with a second home in Murcia. I'm wondering if you could help me. I'm writing to you today from Murcia, so he's in Spain.
Very nice.
Yes. Mar Menor, all of that. He says, I think that I understand the 90-day and any 180-day Schengen area restriction effective from the 1st of January. Okay, so he's a UK resident, but he's currently in Spain. And he was planning on returning in mid-March to the UK. Now, I know this: the 90 days in any 180 days doesn't start until the 1st of January. But if he's already in the Schengen area, so he hasn't been sort of clocked in, you might say, will he be able to stay until mid-March, January, February, March? So more than 90
days. Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be fussed about him leaving. I think the question will be, when he goes back, so say he goes back within the 180 days, starts clicking on the 1st of January, how many days has he used up of his 90 allowance? Because as you say, at the moment, he's perfectly entitled to be there during the transition without any restrictions. That's part of the benefits of free movement, if you like. He's clearly, you know, not resident in Spain. So he's not got the equivalent of pre-settled status, Spanish residency. So he will need to start complying with those rules. So I think the interesting thing is not when he comes back, assuming he's not doing over 90 days, doesn't sound, if it's mid-March, that sounds to me more like 60, 70 days. I think the issue is how quickly can he come back and whether there'll be restrictions then as these days limits kick in. And of course, it's not just Spain, it's other countries as well. So, it's the EU as a whole. It's not just,
Schengen area,
just an individual country.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a lot more, but I'll let you go. I really appreciate your time today. And no doubt, we'll see. I mean, they say a week in politics is a long time, and with this, we'll get some results. Looks as though it's going to be voted through on the 30th in the House of Commons. God knows how they've had chance to read the thing, but even Labour saying they're going to support it.
They can't change it, Stephen. So what the government's basically saying is take it or leave it, and you've got to take it, guys. So, and I think you can say that if anything in the life is a racing certainty, that Parliament approves this deal is an absolute racing certainty. So it's as good as done.
It's as certain as death and taxes. Yeah. Jill, it's always a pleasure. And, we probably won't speak before then, but have a happy new year. And we all look forward to 2021, I think.
Thank you very much. Same to you. Cheers, all in Spain. Enjoy.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Cheers.
TRE. Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
So, las 12:52 minutos, it's 12:52. The WhatsApp number for Countdown to Brexit, and indeed for Europe Today, which of course is tomorrow through till Friday, the number for this programme alone on WhatsApp is +34 722 177 507. +34 722 177 507. Oh, the pen isn't working. Happens to me a lot. Peter in Ben Almadena says, borders are national competences, so Spain may allow greater freedom than the schemes, than Schengen, I guess, other schemes, let's say, although they haven't said anything yet. An example of moving away from the EU on this is COVID travel. Whereas the EU will not add the UK to safe travel, Spain allows travel with a negative test. Yeah. Thanks. I can't disagree with you. I'm sure you're right. My question is, if Spain decides, because it's in Spain's interest, because it wants to make it as easy as possible for Brits to come to Spain and spend their money, then under normal circumstances, there being no border between Spain and France, you know, it's physically there, the infrastructure, and occasionally with COVID or with terrorism, heightened security alerts, you're allowed under Schengen, in exceptional circumstances, you're allowed to man it and demand people show their identity, their passport, and so on. So under normal circumstances, that border would be open. So if Spain does that, then that might be a big sort of gaping hole for the others. Do you see what I mean, Peter? You know, you fly to Girona Airport, for example, so you're relatively close to France, and then rent a car and just head on off to Italy or somewhere. So, yeah, it's not that sort of simple, I suppose. On that, we'll come to just Gibraltar in a moment, just keeping an eye on the clock. James in Ochen says, good breaking news, Stephen. Michael Gove has just done an audiobook of himself reading this new EU Brexit agreement. Maybe you'd enjoy it. God, I'm still on the Barack Obama book, you know. I've got the audio version and the Kindle version. It's 29 hours long, and I'm on hour 19, 20 approaching, something like that. And it's good. And I thought I'd speed him up, you know, because as he himself has said, laughing when I've seen him on some TV shows, that, you know, people do an impression of Barack Obama. He says, they always tend to make it sound as though I speak really slowly. And in fact, it's relatively slow, but it just doesn't work sped up a bit. You know, he's got a very nice speaking voice. So I'm listening to it at a normal speed. I have to confess to you, do you want me to let you into a little secret? Occasionally, when I play you clips, you know, of people, it could be Ursula von der Leyen, Charles Michel, Michel Barnier, Michael Gove, all the players that we've had on this program, and on your Europe Today over the months and months. Occasionally, in the morning, I speed them up. So, I mean, I get the thing, and I think they are speaking particularly slowly about this, because they want to emphasize a thing, but we haven't got enough time in this program. So I get them. And then it depends who it is. Occasionally, Barack Obama, I might put him 20% up. Ursula von der Leyen, she's on 15. Some people speak very quickly, and then they can stay at the normal speed. Pedro Sanchez, for example, Spanish prime minister, definitely don't speed him up. Don't slow him down either, but sometimes it speaks so fast, it's a bit difficult to keep up with the translations. So anyway, thanks, James. But if Michael Gove does decide to do that, I, for one, won't be stand listening to his voice doing it. Tony and Ben Armadina says, the main thing that EHIC doesn't cover is repatriation. Doesn't it? Huh. So if you break, breaking your leg was one thing, but I don't know, something sort of serious, an accident. That is sort of, well, you know, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, but in a way it doesn't make sense. Let's suppose somebody's skiing and they fall down a ravine and they've broken all their bones and they're going to be in hospital for a year. And they're, you know, they're in the Italian, you know, Alps. Wouldn't it be cheaper to have a one-off repatriation than having to pay for them to be in a foreign hospital for a year? Do you see what I mean? Okay, but if you say so. Len, near Murcia, says, does anyone know if the healthcare for UK citizens with Spanish resident permit will still be paid for by the UK? I think so, yeah. I know what you're saying. So you're Spanish resident, so in Spain you don't use the EHIC, you have your SIP card, S-I-P card, SIP card. And, of course, that's paid for by the UK in a sort of a bulk sum, isn't it? We've been through this before, but, for example, £2,000 or £5,000 or euros, yeah, a year, whether you're ill or not. I don't know, because my social security, see, mine is Spanish, So even though I've got a British passport, my EHIC is a Spanish one. So if I go to the UK, I need to go to hospital, for example, an accident or something, I would be officially, for health purposes, I'm Spanish. Do you know what I mean? Peter in Benalmadena says, by leaving Spain, if they do relax the rules, one will be subject to Schengen and may experience difficulties when engaging with other EU authorities, i.e. the police in France, for example. Yeah. Ron in Prague says, I'm sure I've said this before, but surely all EU countries will have to toe the line when the ETS visa scheme kicks off in 2022. Yeah, that's the point. ETS, of course, coming in 2022. This is a tourist visa, rapid application thing, modelled on ESTA, the United States one. You go online, you will, to get into Europe afterwards, say a Brit. You go on online to the relevant website, you apply, fill in all your details, and then pretty quickly you get an electronic response back saying you've been granted a visa, and you'll pay, for example, 10, 20 euros, something like that. And it'll be valid for multiple entries within the period of time. I think the American one is 2 years, I think, the validity. But they do say that even if you've been approved, you might still land at JFK and they change their mind, you know. We're out of time. Thank you for all your company and your comments. I'll read them all, of course. I'll be back tomorrow at 12 o'clock with Europe Today. Thanks to Giles Brown for engineering and, of course, to Jill Rutter and all of you. Hasta mañana.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.